I think there definitely is an educational process to a degree, then I do want to draw them into some of the process. Not all of it, because some of it's quite messy, and especially the way I work at first, but because I think if they can then buy into it and actually become a part of that process so that they're actually engaged in the making of this thing, that's when you're going to be successful. When they're sort of on the outside looking in and you're just telling them, you know, what they should do, that doesn't always result in a happy ending.
Welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. Today we are speaking with Corey Papadopoli. I got it right, apparently. An architect with Elliott & Elliott Architecture in Blue Hill. Corey received his Master's of Architecture from Wentworth Institute of Technology in Boston. Bachelor from Boston. Prior to joining Elliott & Elliott Architecture in 2006, Corey spent 5 years with Peter Forbes, FAIA Architects, living and working in Seal Harbor, Maine, in Puerto Rico, and in Florence. I didn't know. Puerto Rico and Florence. Yeah. Nice. Corey has won numerous awards over the years, including a Maine AIA Honor Award for architecture for one of his projects for Elliott & Elliott. Corey holds NCARB and LEED AP Plus Homes certifications. Our interview today is sponsored by Maine Home Design. Don't miss Corey's AIA Design Theory in the upcoming July issue of Maine Home Design. Thank you for coming into the studio today. To this very early hour, Corey was down running north and south, doing a lot of work and such, and so we're meeting at a very early hour.
Yes.
And I'm in a mill that's not the easiest to find, and I was like, oh, I'll call Corey's cell phone, which you have made a conscious choice, purposefully, to not have a cell phone. Talk me through that a bit. That's interesting.
I guess I've never really liked them or the invasion of them, I think, into one's life. I feel like generally most things that people think are emergencies are not emergencies and can wait. And, you know, they can leave me a message at the office or at home, and I'll get to them when I'm, you know, not traveling or in the middle of doing something else.
So. Sure. And I find that all the moments where you had the ability to process anything and just kind of stare off into the distance, like all those moments now have been purchased by smartphones or whatever. Because the interesting thing to me is you look at a line like at Chipotle or wherever, where people are waiting, everyone will be on their phone. Instead of like maybe talking to a stranger or anything else. It's just immediately you pull out the phone. So you must feel odd at sometimes, like you're standing there and everyone else is looking at their phone and you're like, ah, gosh.
Actually, I feel kind of thankful that I'm not doing that at that moment.
odd and thankful.
But yes, a little out of place.
So where are you from starting out?
I'm from Norwich, Connecticut.
Norwich, Connecticut.
Yep.
Nice. And how did you end up in Maine?
I ended up in Maine via Florence, Italy. I worked for, as you mentioned, Peter Forbes Architects.
Yeah, we had photographed one of his projects in Seal Cove.
Yep, I worked on that one, yeah.
Amazing master bedroom and kind of almost like a glass ship just going into the woods. Yeah. It was an incredible project.
It was very cool to work on that one. But I worked for him while I was in school in Boston. He had an office in Boston at the time, and he closed the office and subsequently opened offices in Seal Harbor, Maine, and Florence, Italy, and offered me a job, which I couldn't accept because I was still in school. So I finished school. I went off and did some things, went to Puerto Rico for a while, worked down there, and came back from Puerto Rico and trying to figure out the next stage of my life. Actually, the day that I landed back in Connecticut, actually, I got an email from Peter offering me a job. And so I told him I'd come work for him, but I wouldn't spend a winter in Maine. And so I moved up to Seal Harbor in March of 2001, and then moved out to Florence, Italy, just after 9/11, actually. Was out there for a few years before I came back to Maine.
Full-time. And how long were you in Italy?
About 3 years.
3 years. How did living in Italy, not just visiting, but living, how did that influence design and just your take on architecture?
Well, I think perhaps the biggest thing, you know, living in Florence, have you been to Florence?
Yeah.
Okay, so Florence is the heart of the Renaissance. I mean, it's a beautiful city. Mm. I think it's one of the most beautiful cities that I've ever been to. And, you know, the bar has been set really high by Alberti and Michelangelo and Brunelleschi and all of these great architects. And, you know, and so when new stuff is done, rather than replicate, you know, what is there, you know, they take what they see and what they've learned, whether it's proportions or geometry or, you know, the creation of space, and they apply it in a contemporary way. And again, the bar is really high, so they don't always meet that bar, but they're at least trying to raise the bar as opposed to, you know, replicate it.
Right.
And that was one of the, I think, the biggest takeaways I got from that was just sort of how new interventions were done within this just beautiful and much older fabric than what we have here.
See, that's an interesting observation that I feel like primarily only a student of architecture is going to see as they look at a city like Florence. It's all going to look like Italian Renaissance, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're able to look at it and say, at this time period, they were doing this, and then Brunelleschi came in and, you know, and took it and moved it here. And in this building here, it didn't succeed, but you can see he was trying, but then he did it again over here, and it was successful. I've always appreciated the European approach to when they do kind of renovation or additions to really old structures,
yep,
how they'll
exactly.
They'll just be really clean glass coming into, you know, like a ancient Roman wall. Mm-hmm. And there's just this embrace of complete, stark, modern, beautiful technology and everything else joining in with these very ancient things. And it's this embrace. And how's that affected your approach to renovations and everything else that you do here in the States?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I've worked on several renovations of historic homes here.
Now, did you work on the one renovation that I think I had photographed of Ellie? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes,
it was
on a project. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's a good example of, you know, here we had this this really, you know, beautiful 19th century house, very well established and defined. And now we're, you know, adding something into it and onto it. And, you know, so I didn't want to, again, replicate what was there, just repeat and carry the motifs all the way through. It was trying to find a new language that worked with the old language, but was clearly distinct. And it would reference back at times, you know, whether it was in the simplification of details, like the baseboard height might be the same, but rather than having, you know, multiple details and reliefs and whatnot, it was just flush with a reveal. But, you know, it sort of matched up and the line continued around, but it was clearly, this is different, this is new, this is old. And so I think what it does is it sort of sets a line, says, you know, we respect what's there, and we're not going to try and recreate that, and we're going to learn from it and move on from it, but clearly there should be a distinction between what's old and new. So I think when the lines get blurred too much, then you start to actually lose some of the integrity of the original.
Yeah, and that's always been a thing that's, for me, has been weird to observe when you see a new building that's on one end, either trying to look like it's an older building, but obviously new.
Yep.
Or then there's these games that are played to really try and make a building look like it's original and old.
Mm-hmm.
And when I worked in a cabinet shop for a while before architecture school, and they finished this set of cabinets that was just, you know, craftsmanship, beautiful wood, blah, blah, blah. And the owner of the place handed me this medieval-looking thing with, like, you know, it had, like, nuts and bolts and everything attached to it. And it was, like, they were attached to pieces of leather and everything else. And he basically said, attack the cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to distress them.
Yes.
You know? And I was just like, what? You know? And so I was sat there for a good part of a day just beating these, like, perfect cabinets that they made, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was this game of trying to make something look old and you know, and to me that was always such a weird idea that you wouldn't just either find value in what's old and, you know, restore it or maintain it to a degree where it needed to be, but really embrace that compared to trying to fake it. And I've always shied away from that trying to fake it thing. But that set of stairs in that project with you that we photographed very much to me references that idea that I was talking about of the glass coming into the stone. You had the, I think, foundation blocks on one side and then these really clean wood stairs, you know, just, you know, such a clean little line coming along them that that I think it's still on our detail page in our portfolio. It's
should
one
be.
Of the one of the nineties should be. So that's how Italy influenced your design aesthetic. How has Blue Hill affected your design sensibilities and how you approach things?
I think that, you know, first of all, I love working at Ellie and Elliot with the group that's there. I think it's a fairly diverse group, but with a lot of similar mindsets in a way. There's enough diversity that we aren't all thinking the same thing, certainly, but we're definitely exploring paths that are parallel.
Right.
And so working in that studio has been really great. They allows me to gives me freedom to explore things and do things, and they've always been supportive of that, which is great. But Blue Hill, I guess, is more about, you know, this coastal community for me, which I really like. Mm-hmm. You know, and I work in Blue Hill and I live in Bar Harbor, so it's sort of two coastal communities that the scale is small, the people are really great and friendly, and it's all about these interactions, these sort of personal interactions and that sort of thing. And so but in terms of how that's influenced me architecturally, it's a little hard to say. I guess I still study the vernacular buildings and I try and learn what I can from them. It's a different vernacular than in Italy, certainly. But it's still, you know, these people built this way for a reason. You know, these buildings, it wasn't just stylistic, but they withstood the elements because of how they were designed, because of how they were built, how they were oriented, and all those sorts of things. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that, and that can be applied to contemporary architecture. So it's sort of trying to, I guess it's about observation. You know, what do you see? Why did they do it? Questioning everything, and then trying to find ways to apply that in a new way.
Yeah, it seems the people that established the, you know, kind of New England vernacular were bringing with them a lot of their past from Europe, but also adapting it to a very independent and farming community, fishing community, coastal living, harsh winters, probably a lot more harsh than they were used to.
Yep.
That influenced all that, and there's a lot less frills and nonsense probably that go into the things that are at least still standing that we see today.
Yep.
You know, when you were working in Italy, what kind of designs were you working on, and what came out of you that then you had to mesh with like the Italian client, right? That the expectations of a European who comes with this whole different mindset and background of appreciation and the things that they value. You know, I've from the times I've been to Europe, there's like an obvious background that they have where they say we appreciate public art and long-term design, long-term planning more so than their American counterparts to a degree.
Yep. Well, oddly enough, the whole time that I was living in Italy, I did not work on a single project in Italy. It was only all the projects I worked on were back in America, and so
really?
I was back and forth quite a bit. It's when I moved back to Maine actually that I began working on projects in Italy.
Wow, that's
interesting. I know it's weird, but that said, the projects that I did work on there, which were all renovations, they were all older buildings by American standards, not necessarily by Italian standards.
Right.
There was one medieval. We were working on one medieval town that was at the top of this hill called Gargonza, and that the owner, it's been in the family for generations, and the owner was trying to turn into sort of destination for weddings, conferences. He's putting a hotel and doing all this stuff there. And that was probably the oldest thing that we worked on. Some of the other stuff was 17th or 18th century, so not quite as old, but still, I think, even then, the mindset of the interactions that I had was, hey, we're not asking you to, you know, replicate what's here. We love what's here. We want to respect that, but you know, we want to see what kind of ideas you have as to what we can do that's different. You know, and so we would explore that with them, and I found them to be very open-minded people, I guess, in general, and that was great.
Do you find that Europeans far more set out on a project thinking we are going to do something new and different here. As a percentage of the population that you've been able to interact with, do they naturally gravitate towards that more so than an American idea of we want to addition renovation here and we just want to make it look like what's already here? Is there a percentage difference there that you've experienced?
I think there is. I mean, certainly not all Italians were wanting to do something contemporary. Some are certainly content with what's there and let's just make it copacetic. But I think that the percentage is definitely higher there in terms of willing to move it in a new direction or advance it forward than here sometimes. I think sometimes we do get caught up in this thing. Well, this is really great. We love this. It's old or it looks old and we don't want to change that. You know, we can't see how it's going to, how we can put something new or different up against that. And so sometimes, frankly, it's an educational thing. It's like, all right, maybe they can't envision it, but let's show them, you know, what it could be. And sometimes, they can then buy into it once they've sort of, they can see it and they can visualize it more. Sometimes they don't. They're still sort of, they don't want to disturb what's there. I think it's coming upon us to educate them and show them what they can do, and then they have to decide. That's right. Where they're going
to
take it.
When it comes to that process of representing to potential or to clients what you're leaning towards designing for them, what do you interact with clients? Do you insist to go more hand sketching all the time, or are you guys moving into 3D modeling? What's been your experience with what works there?
I mean, almost all my projects start by hand, mm-hmm. and usually, especially the early meetings, stuff is done by hand. It's kept loose. I don't like to get too hard-lined with stuff. Just before I came down here, we just did a presentation up there. Six different schemes, all were sketched out by hand and whatever. We pull it into the computer and we'll arrange it and manipulate it in the computer and maybe add some color, that sort of thing. But, mm-hmm. I find it's faster for me to sort of work through ideas by hand, sketch them out. They're not fully fleshed out certainly, but they can convey something, I think. And I think that's usually better than going right to the hard-lined image or the computer graphic that feels like we've designed it all already, and
right.
the process gets lost in there, and it's a harder sell, I think, as well.
Yeah, if you're working with more of this is a final idea, and you will buy the entire thing rather than here's the general direction, and you'll still have say in it. I've found with architects and with a little bit of architectural practice that I did, very little, that the more ambiguous but still getting the general idea across, the more a client was able to say, oh yeah, I could see, they filled in the blanks in their own head more so, and were more a part of that process because of that.
I think that's exactly right.
Here's a real hardball question for you. What do you listen to while you're designing?
In general, nothing, actually.
Really?
I don't like to wear headphones, earphones, whatever. And I generally...
You are an au naturel guy, huh?
Yeah. I'm not a Luddite entirely, but I just prefer to be thinking while I'm drawing, and I find that... Mm-hmm. Music sometimes can be distracting. If I'm in a production mode, where I'm just churning stuff out or I'm going through drawings or whatever, then I'm either listening to classic rock or classical music.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I found just between my wife and I, since we're sharing spaces so often, that music really distracts her while it kind of focuses me sometimes, depending on what I'm doing. Like if I was doing something like designing, musical very much put me in a different state of being able to focus. But if I'm actually like working with words, music, if there's any spoken word or anything else, will just like, nope, can't do that.
Yeah,
it's odd.
Yep.
Yeah, next really hardball question here for you. sustainable design, how do you think that's changed over the last 5 years, and how are you embracing it, rejecting it, who knows?
I think it's certainly coming more into the forefront of design, and I think which I think is a good thing. There are certain things, you know, we do in the office just naturally, whether it's in sort of specifying certain materials or you know, systems that we try and design and that sort of thing, insulation, just simple stuff that really doesn't affect design per se. It's just simple stuff to do, and we feel like we should just do it. We don't even sometimes tell the client, we just specify it or do it and that sort of thing, and it just becomes incorporated into what we do. And we've certainly gone the route where we've had clients that, you know, we have looked at every material that's gone into the project and studied every single aspect of it to make sure that we know where it's coming from, the chain of custody, you know, what its life cycle costs are and all those sorts of things. But we don't get a lot of clients that ask for that, but we have done it before. But, I mean, I think that it's, I don't think that it's a design philosophy per se. I think it's something that can be applied to design regardless of what that philosophy is, but I do think it is important. I mean, the resources we have are limited, and, you know, we're not making more of this stuff, so... architecture is a destructive force by nature, so the less we can, the more we can limit that, the better.
Right. Yeah, the different people I've talked to have stressed also the idea that if you can design well, that's a sustainable feature.
Yes.
Beauty, you know, something.
Yep.
That I mean, if you look, for example, like Florence and Rome, all the mm-hmm. things that are kept around and not needing to be rebuilt because they're initially built for one to just stand up over time.
Yep.
Two, they're just beautiful. So to embrace art and design aesthetic and beauty there, I think is a huge argument. Maybe they need to put that into a green certification.
I agree. Exactly. It's not,
I don't know how they would, you know, subjectively
it
determine that,
tough.
That this
it's
is, this gets
tough.
A thumb down. You're going to have to go back and yeah. didn't pass a beauty blower door test or something.
Yeah.
That's
true.
Do you prefer designing homes that have a specific aesthetic in some way? Do you tend to have a style that you simply gravitate towards, or do you approach every project kind of looking at trying to get an idea of like what's this client want, or do you more so find that people come to you because you particularly enjoy or embrace a certain aesthetic?
I don't think that I start with a particular style in mind. That said, I prefer to be working in a contemporary direction, but I prefer to go through the process with the client and the site, the program, all that sort of thing, and let the style naturally evolve out of that process. I think I usually find that when a project, if you start with a strong concept, that will drive all your decisions further down the road as that concept becomes stronger and more ingrained into the project and almost to the point that the project is sort of telling you what needs to happen.
Sure.
And when you can get a client on board with understanding that the project is telling you that's what needs to happen, then I think you've really succeeded. And they start to understand the underpinnings of the design. But I don't have a particular style or that sort of thing. I think if you look at my projects, they're all quite different.
Yeah.
I just try and find it within the project itself.
So the concept for the design really acts as a foundation for the rest of the aesthetic that follows it often, that as you're working with the client, you kind of reference back to, here's our foundational concept
right.
for this.
Right.
And that's what then informs all the other decisions that are coming out of that.
Yeah. And ideally that goes all the way down to the detail level, how we trim out a window or detail a cabinet or whatever should hopefully tie right back into that original idea.
What are some of the most fulfilling things that you get out of working as a designer?
I mean, I love residential work because I like the personal engagement with clients. It's different than in commercial or institutional work, which I like as well. But that personal interaction, and as you really get to know someone, and they learn to trust you because they're asking you to design probably what is going to be the largest expenditure that they'll ever make.
Right.
And so, you know, those personal relationships I think are great. For me, it's seeing probably the greatest thing though is seeing that initial idea, you know, that started out as a little, you know, marker sketch
squiggle
on a piece of trace. Yeah. And seeing that come to fruition in a completed project and, you know, all the people that made that possible, whether, you know, the client, the contractor, the structural engineer, everyone that was involved that really made that project sing in the end. It doesn't happen all the time, unfortunately, but when it does, it's really a great thing.
In the complete lifespan of a project, what's the most rewarding moment for you?
The most rewarding moment, I guess, is at the end of the project, you know, when the clients, you know, walk into the space for the first time and they feel at home.
Right.
I guess that they feel like this is exactly what they wanted, even though they didn't really know what they wanted in the first place, but somehow, this is what they wanted. And, we made that happen. And that's a pretty great feeling, I think.
Yeah. It's, from the projects of yours that I've worked on the photographic end, combined with, yeah, there's interesting. There's quite a few architects that I pulled, walking through those spaces, mm-hmm. that I pulled from kind of the first time I walked through these mm-hmm. places that you've designed. I remember one specifically had a red stove. And it was a shed roof, garage coming off this way. They had a nice Lego piece of art in one of the kids' bedrooms. But it was just, it had this emotional effect on me in going into the space that was just one of, like, for some reason, like, it just put me at ease.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a lot of just the, with as chaotic and, you know, squirrel as my brain is,
yeah.
To be in a space that in many ways was very minimal and regimented, but to me it just created a sense of calm because of that. This is in order so I can be here and be in peace, and my mind can, you know, sit in the middle of that and then go weird, you know. But to take away those experiences from that first impression, mm-hmm. that many of the people that you're saying, like, the first time they see a home and they feel at home, that tailored to them. I took my first experiences of walking into many of these homes, and many of them yours, and applied them to what I designed for our personal house, and then a friend of mine, you know, detailed out and everything else, because I hadn't practiced architecture for a while, so there's some real shortcomings there. But it's interesting, those first impressions of a space.
Mm-hmm.
What have been some of the most impressionable spaces for you that you've ever been in?
The Pantheon is a space that I could go back to again and again and again.
So many people I talk to say that, and yeah. And that's the first, that will be the first one on my list as well.
Yeah, it's I mean, you take away all the Catholic artifacts that have been put in there but
yeah, and they weren't even originally Catholic, right?
Right.
And the genitalia are chipped off, and
yeah, but just something about that space, the oculus at the top, the way the light moves through. I took my wife there on our honeymoon. She'd never been to Europe before, and we went to Italy, and I think we went back in there three times. Even she was captivated. She's not an architect, but even she was captivated by the space. So I think that's definitely one of them. There's a park in Paris called Parc Citroën, which was designed by a French architect, and it's definitely my favorite public space that I've ever been to. It's got all these glass greenhouses lined up facing a reflecting pool through very carefully orchestrated openings in trees. And then at the end of the reflecting pool, these two very long glass greenhouses. And the first time that I went in there, I think it felt like it was a cathedral for plants. It was...
a cathedral for plants.
Yeah, it was just this really spiritual... and I'm not a religious person, but it was this really spiritual feeling, and I didn't want to leave. You know, I just kept walking around, and everywhere I turned, you know, just saw something or felt something, and I think that was definitely a very moving experience, certainly.
To take it to a more philosophical place around the idea of not being a spiritual or religious person, but being very moved by something towards wonder and awe. What do you take from that? Those moments that are so incredibly inspirational. What do you do with those moments, and how do they influence your actions in the future as it applies to design and just life in general? Do you pull truth out of those somehow, or?
Well, you bring up the word awe, which is a very interesting word, and actually has particular meaning to me. There's a theologian, Abraham Heschel. He wrote about awe, and he described it as being found in the little things, the small things, not necessarily just the great big things that we see, but trying to find it in just the little everyday aspects. And ever since I read that, that resonated with me and struck me as that can apply to architecture. That's how we highlight those moments, these little things, whether it's how light falls through a skylight, or the view out to the garden, or the smell of the sea breeze. Those little things are where we find awe, and to me, really meaningful. I do try and find those moments. It's not just about, all right, how much glass can we put and highlight the largest view that's there. It's how do we frame things in a certain way so that we highlight those little seemingly insignificant moments that really are profound. If we can do that successfully, I think then we can make the everyday significant and find, I guess, as you say, truth in those things. And so I'm always looking for those little moments and trying to find ways to incorporate those into what I do.
So going back to the cell phone thing a little bit, like the changing way in which we spend our days and notice and process and how much of our attention is taken up by this little box that we hold in our hand. How do you think that's affecting the general population and how they interact with space? Because instead of like the choice that you've made to say, I'm going to, go through my day and have these blank moments where I can take in and notice and process spaces, previous relational interactions, whatever, when I'm alone, I'll have those times to do that. Today, so many people are going to constantly just be on that phone answering emails, text, Instagram, whatever. How do you think that's affecting the general population and their interaction with built space?
I think that's a very good point, because I think it does definitely affect, and not necessarily in a good way.
It seems like we're becoming just like we're putting blinders on constantly rather than sitting and having a,
yeah.
I won't take your answer.
No.
I have a real problem with cutting people off. My wife was pointing that out again yesterday. She's like, you need to. So,
no worries.
Go ahead.
No, I think it's absolutely true. I to go back to this Pantheon moment. The first time I went in the Pantheon was back in 1999. So, people weren't really carrying cell phones around with them.
I would have been there, maybe 2 years after you.
Yeah. Maybe. So, cell phones weren't the prolific things that they are these days.
Yeah, they were just a little camera flip phone at best.
Right. And people still had cameras, right? But, and so my initial experience with that, was, again, you walk in and everyone is sort of staring upwards and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of engagement with the building, with the space. And, when we went on our honeymoon, my wife and I went on our honeymoon, the first thing that I noticed was how many cell phones were pointed up towards, to take these pictures. And it's as you watch people come in, it's the first thing they do, pull out their cell phone and take a picture. It's not, look at the space, think about it.
Soak it in.
Right. It's, all right, I need to capture my Instagram moment.
Post it, tag it, move on.
Yeah, exactly. And go on to the next thing on my list here. Where's the next tour stop? And I think... everything is more frenetic. Is the the pace of things, you know, there's no time, there's less time to sort of slow down, take things in, think about them. Everything is sort of, you know, we're used to having information at our fingertips, being able to get it in an instant moment notice, and not having to wait for things. And so that part of enjoyment of things is, I think, lost on us, or getting slowly lost on us.
The first time I went to Italy, first time I went to Rome, was with architecture school, mm-hmm. with my architecture school. And I don't think I brought a camera. We were just sketching.
Yep.
And so instead of, you know, even just not having a phone, and even if I had a camera, like this last time that I went back, I, you know, tried to leave my phone in the hotel and take a camera because I'm a camera guy now. but the comparison, like I came away, now it might have been just that it was the first time I was in Italy and I was vastly impressed, but the first time I went, I only had a sketchbook and a pen. Mm-hmm. And I sat there and, you know, sketched the Pantheon and sketched Piazza del Popolo, or, you know, you name it. And all those spaces and moments, I took more time with them and they soaked into my psyche, consciousness, memory, more, and I pulled more out of them later, I think. Mm-hmm. Just that idea of, you know, just looking repeatedly and mimicking through your hands, you know, that was, that really left an impression on me. And then you take it one step away from there to, you know, traveling Rome with an actual camera, where I'm taking the space in and framing it, thinking about how I'm framing it, how I did this last time, and then, you know, taking it a step further, someone just with a cell phone who's just kind of move on. It's just, it continually goes one step disconnected, and I got to think there's some kind of detriment to some degree to the overall population to be able to do that, but also some kind of, in some way, benefit that we've got at least more information. But there's this conflict of the ability to absorb and truly internalize these situations, these, you know, spaces, aesthetics, and every, like, really internalize those compared to just quickly observing them and moving on. I guess we'd have to talk to a psychologist maybe, or a sociologist about those. I don't know.
You know, when I was in school, no offense here, but I wrote design philosophy, and part of that design philosophy was railing against architectural photography.
Oh, yes.
And not that, you know...
But you have to be able to prove to another client what you've been able to do.
You do. And it was not so much that, you know, photographers are evil, or that their magazines are bad, or that sort of thing. It was how architecture needs to be experienced. It's a three-dimensional construction, and it needs to be experienced. You need to move through it, in it, around it, on it in some cases. And when you reduce that to a two-dimensional image, you know, and it's got to be that right image, you know. I remember that, you know, when I was working in New York City, that we would sketch or model things up, thinking about the final photograph. You know, how is this going to look when we shoot this? You know, and which is not a great way to be thinking about things. Like, you know, again, it's how do we interact with the space? How does that affect us? And you know, when we reduce that to a simple cell phone shot and put it, you know, so that we can get the right Instagram moment or whatever it may be, then we, you know, we lose all of that experiential qualities of the architecture. And again, when the first instinct is to go in and just pull out the cell phone and snap a photo, and before you even take a moment to study the space and think about how your engagement with it, then something is lost there, unfortunately.
Yeah, we already have a ding from a cell phone trying to interrupt our conversation.
It's not my cell phone.
Yeah. So what you were saying there applies to how architects advertise and how it's changed over the last century, right? I've interacted with some older architects that have said it was frowned upon to advertise.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was just kind of a gentleman's agreement to some degree that you did not advertise. You worked and did your thing, and people experienced it, and you got more work by word of mouth, by what you're saying, people experiencing what you've done telling other people and do it, mm-hmm. you know, and you got work that way. And that's a really interesting dynamic to me. And not to say, I mean, you just simply cannot stand in the way of the changing culture or progress.
Yep.
But it is true that I 100% know that you can manipulate a project to be represented better than it is, mm-hmm. because I've done it. And I'll have some clients that I don't, you know, like, this looks so much better than, you know, they'll have a project that got value engineered, but we were still able to make it look like it wasn't value engineered, mm-hmm. you know? And there's that ability to stretch that. Yeah. And then you turn it into advertising and, you know, you can kind of fake it till you make it. And, you know, and it's just such an interesting thing that some of these older architects are like, you know, you don't advertise, but yet the new breeders are like, dude, if we're not advertising, we're not going to get business. Yep. We have to be on social media. We have to adapt to the current culture. So it's always that struggle of the old way of doing things that had merit, yep. and the new possibilities. Yep. And those new possibilities seemingly always bring potential pitfalls, but we have to adapt to them and hopefully have an educational process of embracing them in a healthy way, in some way, hopefully. Yep. But yep. They say the most disruptive thing to society was initially probably the car, because instead of, I mean, just the other day, my two sons and I chose to start to walk to their grandparents' house, mm-hmm. rather than drive. And my wife was going to drive and meet us halfway in between and take us the rest of the way. And we only got like 2 miles before I understood, like, we came to what used to be a tiny little kind of town center.
Yep.
That's not a town center now, but there was like a church and a couple little houses there. So mm-hmm. 100 years ago, that space felt like a different town, but we were just in another part of Biddeford now that is just a road, you know? But 100 years ago, it must've felt like, oh man, they're way down there at Duddle Corner or whatever it was. And that's just that whole dynamic of changing and embracing and moving forward in a positive way. It's really difficult. And it's interesting to me again that you've chosen to, like, well, this aspect of it, this whole cell phone thing, I'm just set that aside because I can still get done what I need to get done. And it probably adds a lot of value to what you do in many ways, while you might be a little bit harder to get a hold of. You know, I mean, I couldn't call or text you to find the entrance today, but you got here no problem.
Yep.
I just stepped out saying, oh, there he is.
Yeah, I found it.
So what have been, list me your top three rewarding projects that you've ever worked on.
Top three rewarding projects. I did a house in Surrey that you photographed over the water.
Oh, that smaller one,
yep.
on the columns, just
yep.
right over the water. That,
yep.
That's such a nice place.
Really tremendous clients and a very difficult site that had a whole series of challenges, and the site itself is smaller than a lot of the houses we design, a great opportunity to build something, a place that normally would be unbuildable.
That had to have been grandfathered in some way, right?
It was. There was an existing structure there that was not in good shape and not compliant with FEMA regulations. But that's the only way we were able to build.
So for reference, if you're listening and or watching, this house basically went from the road, just dropped down to essentially the ocean.
Yeah, 22 feet down.
Yep. Yeah, just dropped right off, and the house just goes over out from the road. And so from the roadside, it just looks like almost like a single story,
you know,
minimalist ranch aesthetic. But then on the other side, there's these large columns and this great granite, kind of patio area below with steps that go into the water at high tide. So you can unload a boat under the house, right into the water under the house. And
it's very cool.
Yeah. The aesthetic of that one in that location was just, really cool.
The very first project I worked on for, Elliott & Elliott was a house in Freeport. And, it's if you know our work, it's sort of these white three series of white Cape Cod,
mm-hmm.
very simple Cape Cod structures with connected by these very minimalist glass
mm-hmm.
Bridges or components, And that again was, they were some great clients and a very tricky process where initially they wanted to, there was an original Cape Cod house there and that had been there since the mid 19th century. The family had, they had raised their family and the kids were gone now, but they had raised their family in it. It was deteriorating and not in great state. But they wanted to somehow, you know, it's so iconic in the raising their family. They wanted to somehow reflect that and initially, almost rebuild it. And so that was a project where, you know, we convinced them that, you know, rebuilding is not necessarily the right thing. We can, you know, reference the Cape Cod architecture, and we studied and looked at, you know, how do we simplify that down to what its essence is. But inside, that's not the way people live anymore. You know, they don't live huddled around a central fireplace, you know, and with very, you know, small windows, you know, because it was, you know, the cold winds and that sort of thing. It's so, convince them that, you know, let's open this up. Let's really expand this idea. We can use this iconography of the Cape Cod house and link these pieces together with these elements that really open up to the view that you have and really open up to the gardens that you, you know, want to bring inside and stuff. And the end result of that was pretty cool. Some pretty cool spaces.
Yeah. I've seen the photographs from that. It's a really nice place.
And so now number three, this is hard actually. I guess the Maniatis house that we mentioned earlier, which you photographed as well, is Peter Forbes' house.
The technical details on that one must have been time-consuming.
Yes, and it was a 4.5-year construction process.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Very lengthy, very involved. You know, these two long bars that are actually sort of one bar that's broken and connected by a glass stair. And then, as you said earlier, the gable end of it is all glass, and it's all spider supported, so there's no frames or anything like that.
Yeah, all, it's just like a smooth skin of glass on the outside.
With these large Duratherm lift slide doors that open up on the two sides that can create a 20-foot clear opening on both first and second floor. Anyway, another great client who really, really pushed us. And I wasn't so much involved in the design of that house. I was more involved in the detailing and interiors and construction management of it. But it was still a pretty cool project to work on.
I mean, and that was early on in your career. Yeah, that must have been a baptism by fire to work on something of that complexity.
Yes. And, you know, working with Peter, Peter can be very demanding, and he's very demanding not only of his employees but also of his clients. but actually, it was great. He and I got along great, and we still do. We still talk. And you know, it was definitely that working on that project with him in that office definitely opened up my eyes to, you know, this notion that we talked about earlier about how this initial concept should transcend stuff all the way down through to the smallest detail. And, you know, there were a lot of details drawn on that project. We drew them all on 8.5 by 11 sheets, and we kept them in binders. And so we had a 3-inch ring binder and then another 1-inch ring binder of details just for that project that were accumulated over the course of 4.5 years.
We actually shot that house for
New England Home,
yep. I believe. Yep. And it was Kyle. Yep. He had a very specific shot list. So we probably got 6 to 8 images out of it. And there was so much more that I wanted to shoot. Like I wanted to be out in the woods, like 40 feet up at night with the end of that glass ship going into the wood, you know, and just.
It glows. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It was incredible. But he was very conscientious to getting out of there before the client came home or your client came home. I think I remember the owner had the last model of the 911s that still had rain gutters on them. And I remember at the time thinking, like, that's like an early 90s or late 80s Porsche. That's weird. But since then, I've kind of looked into them and I was like, oh, that's like one of the last, I think, air-cooled engine. It's like a real, like, for people who are into that kind of thing, like the one, you know. But, So how important is it that the clients that you work with understand why you're doing what you're doing, the process of what you're doing? Do you really bring a client into your mind and how you're doing things, or do you generally keep them on the surface of, like, here's my idea, or do you really walk them through an educational process to a degree?
I think there definitely is an educational process to a degree. If we're going to get them to buy into what we're doing, then I do want to draw them into some of that process. Not all of it, because some of it's quite messy, and especially the way I work at first, but definitely some of that process. And because I think if they can then buy into it and actually become a part of that process so that they're actually engaged in the making of this thing, that's when you're going to be successful. When they're sort of on the outside looking in and you're just telling them, you know, what they should do, that doesn't always result in a happy ending. It's sometimes different with commercial institutional work, but with residential work especially, we want them engaged in that process and a part of it.
So last but not least, I hear you're working on your own home. Now, yeah. As an architect, and this is speaking from experience of, I'm not an architect, but I have an architectural background. When you come to designing your own home, you know how much your own design aesthetic and ideas and everything grow and change over time. But as you said, you're making the investment of your lifetime, essentially. Yeah. How on earth are you approaching, you know, designing your own home? And do you really think you're going to be able to stay in it and not, like, continually pull parts of it apart and redo it? And
well, I actually built my house originally back in 2007, and okay. it was a one bedroom, two room house basically.
Wow.
So it was one. It's a long bar basically, and the kitchen, dining, living, and bedroom were all one big long space.
Now, did you build it yourself?
The first time around, I helped build it and finished it.
Yep.
But I had hired a contractor, Tobin Peacock, who's a good friend of mine, to get me mostly underway and get through most of it. And then I would basically help them one day a week and then work on the weekends around it. But it was 760 square feet, very small. You know, I built it for $70,000, didn't have a lot of money. But, you know, it served my needs at the time. When I proposed to my wife, and
gonna have to get a second bar here for that,
right? And she has two daughters.
Oh wow!
Yep. So
Insta family.
Yeah, yeah. And now all of a sudden, the one bedroom, one bathroom house is a little bit
pay for the daughters.
Even then, it's probably not enough.
Yeah, right.
So now I needed to rethink things, and so actually, I proposed to her. We drove down to Florida to visit her sister who lives down there. So all of us drove down to Florida, and I proposed to her down there at Christmas time. And, you know, it's a long drive down and back. And so the whole way back, I sort of was in my mind thinking, okay, the house is too small. I've got to do something. What am I going to do? You know, and so
after you proposed,
after I proposed,
now you're thinking pragmatically. Yeah.
So now,
like,
now
what
I'm
have I done?
Right. Well, well, there was that, but no, that was brief. I hope my wife's not listening. So now all of a sudden I started going through this design process in my head, you know, like,
right.
What can I do? You know, I really want to stay in the house, but obviously we've got to add on to it and stuff. So what am I going to do? So actually, you know, over the course of 24 hours, I sort of went through a whole bunch of iterations in my mind,
right.
Processed them, played them out, and then came up with this one idea. So when we got back, I sat down with my wife and I basically sketched out this plan, you know, that I had come up with in my head. And, you know, and she said, well, can we do this and that? And so we tweaked a couple little things, mm-hmm. and then basically she said, yeah, that works. And that is more or less the plan that I have been building. And so this time around, though, I have been building this myself. You know, I had somebody come in and do the earthwork and foundation, and basically have done everything from there up. So,
oh, wow, cool.
I threw a couple of parties, had some friends come over, some people from work, and we did some big chunks of framing. And then basically, I've just been sort of finishing this thing out. So framed it, sheathed it. I had somebody come in and do the insulation and sheetrock and electrical and plumbing, and did everything else, flooring, tile, painting,
What's the aesthetic that you gravitated towards for your own space?
So, as I said, the first one is a sort of long, thin bar. And basically what I did was I added a second, even longer bar. Actually, so the addition is larger than the original house. Mm-hmm. Onto the back side of it and connected it via a glass bridge, which becomes the new entrance to the house. So there's a new pathway and stairs that come up to this glass bridge. So now you enter between these two structures. Mm-hmm. And I had setback issues.
We all have issues.
Yeah, I know.
I've never heard of the setback issue.
It was a setback, but I had a side yard setback issue and a septic field setback issue. So I had to position this bar in a certain way and then rotate.
How many feet do they require septic setback from well up where you're at? Is it
from a well?
Is it the well same across the board?
It's 100 feet.
Yeah, that's what ours was. Yeah. All right, sorry.
No, it's fine. So I had to rotate the house, rotate the addition 5 degrees and shift it, sort of tied to certain things on the site, but basically then joined the two together again with this sort of glass bridge piece, and which, when you come up, you look under it and you see this.
So it's truly a bridge.
It's truly a bridge. It's not connected to the ground.
Cool.
Suspended between the two buildings, and it's glass both sides. You enter through a large two-panel sliding door, and there's one large fixed glass window on the backside, so you see through it and you see under it.
It's nice.
Yep. So I was able to add a mudroom and stuff off of that, and so there. It's very clean, simple, contemporary, minimalist. More glass in this one than what I did originally. I did do some things differently.
Right.
I didn't even thinking about what I had done 10 years earlier. I tweaked it and modified it and. Made some changes to it. I didn't change anything in the original, but except that the bedroom is now a living room. But
so now the an interesting thing, and maybe we'll end on this, but the interactions between the commonality of the people I've spoken with that are the architect in a relationship, and then the people that have to live with them at home.
Uh-huh.
Because you went to school for this. You know everything, and people pay you money to make decisions on their homes, but no prophet is accepted in his hometown. When you go home and you pitch these ideas like, no, sweetie, what I want to do here is I want to put this there, and I can explain all the reasons why I want to do that. Yeah. My wife and I will, get into these discussions about, people pay me to go and photograph, and I move things around, and I place things here and there because I know, and I'm great at this, and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, you're not that great. Welcome home, buddy. And it's not in a in hateful way or anything else, but there's always that very personal dynamic of I've known you forever, and so how do you deal with that dynamic of having all these very strong opinions about homes and design and placement and flow and light and all that against someone who might not be anywhere near as educated or experienced as you, but you're in this very interpersonal relationship to deal with that.
Yep. Well, it helps that she liked the original house that I built.
Oh, good. Okay.
So I was able to expand on those ideas, but yeah, there definitely are times where she'll be like, "Well, I think we need to change out the furniture for this, or we should do this there," and I'm like, "I'm not so sure," Victoria is the younger of the two, of her two daughters. And, I sometimes try and get her on my side to help sway the bow sometimes, but sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And,
right.
It's about compromise. So, changing a pillow on the couch or whatever is not really going to destroy the vision of things, but as much as we want to control everything that we can, I think we're fairly compatible in a design sense, and which is good because it could have gone very differently.
Right. Cool. Well, it sounds like you've been able to keep your relationship in a good enough space where she trusts you, and so you're not going to run into these huge issues and everything else. That's great. Well, again, thank you so much for coming out early in the morning to do this conversation and eventual portrait over there. And glad we could catch you on your way back from Boston. That commute to Blue Hill, it's a great place to live. I've been there many times, but I would always imagine as I'm passing Portland, I'm like, I got three more hours to go, or I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a great place. If you haven't been there, visit. Yeah, and that's where they did Scarlet's Web is written around there, the Blue Hill Fair, right?
Yep.
Cool. We'll end on that. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, and look for Corey's article in the upcoming issue of Main Home Design. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.